Welcome to Headlines. This is David Lichtenstein. This week we have with us Rabbi Asher Lopatin, the head of Yeshiva Chovevei Torah and the head of the Open Orthodoxy Movement. We also have with us Rabbi Avram Gordimer, a critic of Open Orthodoxy. We'll have a discussion. You can listen to us Matzah Shabbos from 11 to 12 midnight on WMCA 570 AM. Or on the Nachum Segal Network, Monday morning at 11 a.m. at NachumSegal.com. You can find all our shows at HeadlinesBook.com under the audio podcast section. We now have a new hotline with all our previous shows, 732-806-8700. You can email us always at info@HeadlinesBook.com. Well, Open Orthodoxy has obviously been, you know, something very hot, you know, very discussed, and this show, I wasn't sure whether to have it or not. I actually got permission from both Nova Minsk Rebbe and Reb David Cohn. So I'm going to be very unjudgmental and allow the listeners to make their own choices.
We have on the phone with us Rabbi Asher Lopatin, who is the president of Yeshiva Chovevei Torah in Riverdale. He was previously the leader of Anshei Shalom in Chicago, and actually the rabbi of the current mayor of Chicago. He's a graduate of Boston University. In 1989, he got a Master of Philosophy from Oxford. Additionally, he's a Rhodes Scholar and a Truman Scholar and a member of Phi Beta Kappa, probably one of the most accomplished degreed people I've ever interviewed. Additionally, he's a musbach of Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik. Welcome, Rabbi Lopatin.
Thank you. It's good to be on your show.
So, Rabbi Lopatin, if you could give us, because a lot of our people are sort of, you know, everything's third hand, can you give us a brief overview of what is Open Orthodoxy?
Great. Well, it'd be my pleasure. What people call Open Orthodoxy really is really just modern Orthodoxy. Maybe it's reclaiming true modern Orthodoxy. And it's really Orthodoxy, and I really feel it's just part of Torah true Yiddishkeit. The term came from Rav Avi Weiss, who, when he was thinking of starting a yeshiva, where people could be open about all their questions and everything could be discussed on the table, he felt the term open was perfect. I do not see it, and the yeshiva doesn't see it as a separate movement or anything like that. It's really just, in some ways, the best way to describe Open Orthodox learning is a method of learning where people feel comfortable and safe to struggle with issues that they face in the contemporary world, to ask the questions, to not be ashamed of offering possible understandings of halacha. But besides that, it's really very much like what you see in any other Orthodox yeshiva, people learning the Chavrusa, Rebbeim, learning from the Rebbeim, using classic sources, and also classic contemporary sources of Avadi Yosef, Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Zalman Nechemi Goldberg, all the names that come up as poskim, the Tzitz Eliezer. So all the names from the Gemara to the Rishonim to Acharonim and to today's contemporary poskim, that's what you would hear. And the idea really is that we should not be afraid of the world around us. We should not be afraid of the challenges that the contemporary world, contemporary society, challenge us with. But actually, we should welcome them and feel secure in our Yiddishkeit, secure in our method of learning, and secure that we can face these challenges and thrive with them, and not, instead of hiding from them, really embrace them.
So, Rabbi Lopatin, I went through Avi Weiss's Open Orthodoxy, A Modern Orthodox Rabbi's Creed, would that sort of be the document of Yeshiva's Chovevei Torah? Would that be the operative theology behind the yeshiva?
I think
I'm referring to what he wrote in 1997.
Yeah, and that really kicked off. The yeshiva is 17 years old. It really kicked it off. And so I think we operate within that theology and within that understanding. I'm not sure that every student that comes in reads that, but yeah, I think that what we're doing at Chove is consistent with that theology, with that document. And it's definitely the inspiration for who we are, for our Talmidim. We have 108 Yismachim going out into the world. And I think, yes, it's definitely the inspiration for them.
So the Orthodox world is concerned, and I'm sure you've been reading about it in the press, that there is shinuyim, there are differences that will lead to halachic differences between Orthodoxy and modern Orthodoxy. Can you think of any halachic differences between them?
Well, I think that there are a lot of differences within the Orthodox world in general, and so definitely, let's say, on Yom HaTzma'ut, saying Hallel with a bracha, not saying Tachanun. And the truth is, saying Hallel with a bracha is a major halachic issue. So that's something that, you know, there's a lot of disagreement within their shinuyim. Some people see that within Orthodoxy. I would say that a lot of the things that look very different as we're looking at issues of, I guess, attitudes towards women's involvement with learning, with leadership, with even in the services, a lot of them don't involve halachic issues, attitudes towards people that were normally excluded. For instance, how do you deal with a gay couple that comes to your shul? How do you deal with on college campus? How do you deal with someone on college campus that is has issues with their hashkafot and their orthodox? And all these things really, in general, don't involve halacha. They involve much more, definitely Mesorah, but they involve also, I would say, almost the aesthetics of Judaism. Like, it looks different. Having a woman give a Dvar Torah in shul, it looks different. It feels different. Having a woman carry a Sefer Torah through the women's section, through the Ezra's Nashim, so you still have the Mechitza. And you look up in the Aruch HaShulchan, and it says explicitly that women can touch the Torah, and there's no issue of Nida. So it doesn't involve halacha, but it definitely involves aesthetics, and a lot of it is really community-based, that if you live in a community where women don't even go to shul, or if they do, really, a man would never see a woman in shul. They're behind a very high mechitza. Then aesthetically, it looks very strange. If you're in a community where women are in shul and women are singing, an Orthodox community where women are singing, women are participating in that way on the other side of the mechitza, just like the men sing, the women sing, and all that, then it doesn't look as strange. So it's really, you know, issues of halacha like kashrus, issues of tarat hamishpacha, really the classic issues of davening, of Shabbos, those issues, I don't think there's really much difference between a modern Orthodox, a progressive Orthodox, a liberal Orthodox, Haredi, you know, but really it's more the aesthetics, I would say.
So let me ask you some issues that are really not halacha, but they go more to hashkafa. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to quote, you know, at random. I spent the last day or so sort of on Facebook going through some of the... So here are some quotes, and I'll tell you who their names are, so because they're not from you, but they're from different members, I guess, who are part of either the Anhala, or I have Rabbi Yisachar Katz, who is the head of Gemara, I guess, in Halacha at Yeshivas Chayvei Torah. And I also have some from Rabbi Zev Farber, who's a musmach and who's a board member of the International Rabbinic Membership. And here are some things that I think that just sort of sound a little bit mechudash, let me say. Here's a quote, This is from Rabbi Farber. Avram and Sarah are folkloristic characters, factually speaking. They are not my ancestors or anyone else's. I mean, for somebody to say that Avram Avinu is not our grandfather, that the Avis, we're not, you know, Aleke Avram, Aleke Yitzchak, Aleke Yaakov is just a folklore. I think that most Orthodoxy and modern Orthodoxy would have an issue with it. He says these are easily identified. They're ahistorical. They fit into the genre of folklore, allegory, and intentionally fantastic character in order to explain some aspect of the world in which we live. Let me continue. He says that the 12 Shvatim really didn't exist. And he says Yetzias Mitzrayim never occurred. This is all in one large paper that I printed out here from Rabbi Farber. I think most Orthodox would have an issue with saying that we don't come from the Avos.
And I agree with that. I have an issue also with that. First of all, Torah Mesinai, Torah Mishamai is a non-negotiable. It's a pillar of Orthodoxy. And we make sure that our students, to get smicha, you have to believe that. It's a free country, but if you want to be part of our yeshiva, you have to believe that. Second of all, really, these belief in Yetzias Mitzrayim and in the Avos and Himahos, these are, I think, our basic principles of belief of Yiddishkeit. I think Rabbi Farber, so some things he says I disagree with and Yeshiva disagrees with, and I really do feel as uncomfortable as you do. I think that he uses a lot of language that if you really sat down with him and really unpacked it, he would say, in some ways, of course, I believe in Yetzias Mitzrayim, but, this whole idea of ahistorical, that, okay, if what I believe is history needs to be proven by actual historic archaeological evidence, okay, then that's one thing. But, how does he know for sure it did not happen? Does he have evidence that it did not happen, Yetzias Mitzrayim or anything like that? So, I think that these things, and I turned to the head of Ramah's day school in New York, Dr. Eric Grossman, and he says a lot of these sensitive issues when it comes to history, when it comes to how you explain Midrashim and how do you understand the pshat of the text with the Avos and Mahos and all sorts of things, they need to be handled not in an article that gets put up on Facebook or wherever, but sometimes when someone has sfeikos, you have to sit with them one-on-one and look at it and discuss different pshatim. The Rashbam might disagree with the Rambam, and Ramban would disagree with the Rambam. So, they have to be handled very sensitively. But I agree with you, and I think that the Hevra at Yeshivat Chol Vei Torah and our Rabbanim would be very, they all believe, I can vouch for them, they all believe in Yetzias Mitzrayim. They all say they daven three times a day and they mean it, and that the Avos are our Avos. And I think that I share your discomfort with them. And, when a student has questions, it's good to ask those questions. It's good for a student to say, I'm really troubled, but how do we explain Yetzias Mitzrayim when it doesn't fit in with what archaeologists believe or something? Okay, let's sit down and let's talk about it. But it all starts and it has to be contingent on a belief in our Masoret and our...
So here, Rabbi Lopatin, here's a quote from Rabbi Katz. That was Rabbi Farber. Here's a quote from Rabbi Katz, who's the chair of the Department of Halacha and Gemara, and he says, and this is in a Facebook quote, April 3rd, 2015, he says, "Biblical fiction. The retelling of the Exodus story is fiction. It is a record of God's conversation with fictionalized characters." I mean... This is a Rosh Hashiva there. Could you understand why... could you think of any yeshiva in our history where Rosh Yeshiva would get up and say, according to the rabbis, the retelling of the Exodus story is fiction, it's biblical fiction, it's a record of God's conversation with fictionalized characters? Moshe and Aaron are fictionalized characters, too. How does a Rosh Yeshiva get up and say something like that?
Well, first of all, he's one of our rabbanim. Our Rosh Yeshiva is Rav Dov Linzer, but he's one of our Chashava rabbanim, Rabbi Katz, and he's a big maimin. And I think that the reason it is unique as Lilei Torah, because I don't think Rosh Yeshiva and most of these people talk about what does fiction mean? What does fiction mean? What does literary fiction mean? And it doesn't mean that it's not true. I think that's a very good, and you know, that would be a very simple and simplistic understanding of fiction. What he's saying is that, and he said this all along, is that the Torah is not out to be a book of history. It's not a, that takes it, really demeans the Torah when we just use the Torah as a book of history. It's much more significant. So I think when he talks about fiction, he talks about it on a much deeper level. Not that it's not true. Not even that it didn't happen or that it's fake or anything like that. But that it has a deeper, deeper message and a deeper, deeper import that, you know, the role of Torah is not to teach us historical truth. Yeah, you know, Chinami, they all happen. That's, you know, the role of Torah is much more similar to the literary role of fiction, which is goes beyond that, you know, did it happen? How did it happen? How do historians think it happened? It's much more to teach us important lessons. And that's very traditional.
Given the data to which modern historians have access, it is impossible to regard the account of mass exodus from Egypt or the wilderness experience, Yitzhias Mitzrayim or the Midbar, or the coordinated, swift, and complete conquest of the entire land of Canaan under Yeshua as historical. He says it's impossible to see Yitzhias Mitzrayim, the Midbar, or even Klishas Haaretz by Yeshua, right, with L'shaito, Shalayla, Shalasad Lava, but he says it's impossible to view it as historical. And this is from a Facebook quote. This is the Torah.com, Torah History Judaism, Part 5.
Right. Yeah, and I think
these are very difficult things for a rabbi to write. It's impossible to regard it as historical.
So when you face...
He's not saying that it's more than historical. He's saying it's impossible to regard it as historical.
Right, so nothing's impossible. I wouldn't have written that. But actually, you know, what he's saying is, like, let's get away from feeling compelled to look at these as that it had to have happened. And what he's trying to do is saying, like, I don't care whether historians think it happened. I don't even care whether historians think it's impossible. Fine, let's even grant that they say it's impossible. I want to look for the real meaning of our Torah. And why did Yeshua write that? And what does it try to teach us? And I think that, you know, when you're looking at the scientific world, I think a lot of times we cower to it. And we think that that is what's critical and that it is critical that historically something has happened, you know, from a scientific point of view. And if not, then our whole world will collapse. Our whole Torah world will collapse. And what he is saying is that it doesn't matter. I don't care whether historically this happened in this certain way. What I care about is the message that HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the Nevi'im, HaKadoshim, are teaching us through these writings. So what he's trying to do is really tell Torah-believing Jews, Torah-loving Jews, that really separate. Yes, it's very important. You know, archaeology is important, and you know, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik taught that you have to zechor yemos olam b'mishnos dor v'dor. You have to remember history. It's important, but don't think that that defines Torah. You don't think that science and history defines Torah, because it doesn't. Torah is way beyond that, and that's really what he's trying to do there.
Okay, so when he writes that it's folklore, allegory, it doesn't really mean that.
That's, you know, Shad, Drash, Remez, and so on. And folklore, you know, I think that it's important for us to understand. We normally think of folklore as things that didn't happen, as, you know, Bubba Mises. And what he's trying to say is, like, let's get beyond, let's elevate that, and let's look. Something, you know, theologians and historians use the term myth. And when we think of myth, it's like, oh, it's a Bubba Mises that never happened. But actually, they put myth, anthropologists put myth on a real high pedestal. Like, ooh, this is an underlying myth of the religion. So I think, yeah, the language is sometimes we think of something as folklore as it diminishing, and definitely what he wants to do is place it on a higher madriga and beyond.
So when he writes it's impossible, what does he mean when he writes it's impossible to believe it as historical?
I think what he's saying is that if you're following historians and archaeologists and scientific theory, it would seem to be impossible. Now, I'm very much more postmodern than perhaps even, you know, anyone in Yeshiva is. And so I don't put impossible, it's impossible. You know, my father always taught me that, new math can say 2 + 2 = 5. So, you know, I don't know how he did that, but... You know, I don't like that word impossible. You know, even when we look at, halachot, we have to, you know, we sometimes come up with very surprising things that it's impossible for, you know, the poskim to have ever said this, you know, for the chidah to have said something so radical. I don't like the word impossible, but I think what he means is that if you're following the lead of historians and archaeologists, then it would seem to be impossible. But that's not the lead we follow. We follow Hashem, we follow our Masoret, and we believe in it way michutz, you know, from all the what science tries to really diminish it and sort of enclose our Torah in those kind of terms. We want to go beyond that.
Now, how would you say, Rabbi? Here's enough some more quotes from Rabbi Zev Farber in a number of different articles.
And I should say, Zev Farber is brilliant. He's very smart, but he's, you know, doesn't play any role in our yeshiva. I wasn't aware that he was on the board. He's definitely a member of the International Rabbinic Fellowship, you know, and he has every right to his opinion.
And he's also the editor of the journal.
No, we don't. There's no...
The Kerem, it says. That's what it says on his website.
Yes.
It says he's the editor of the journal, of the Maharat journal, Kerem. That's what it
yes,
says.
Yes, so Maharat is Maharat's a wonderful yeshiva, and they train women, but it's not affiliated with Chovei Torah. So Rabbi Sarah Hurwitz is the dean of that, and so that's a separate thing. That's not he doesn't edit any journal for Chovei Torah. And again, he's brilliant. He's wonderful. You know, he's hopeful. I hope that he's addressing a group of more skeptical people and that it helps with Kiruv and helps bring them to the Torah in a very different way, but he's not associated with Yeshiva. I frankly disagree with much of his writing strongly.
Because there is an online, a very warm haskama from the Yeshiva to, you know, some of the things he says. Right, like if you want,
I would love to see that because I'm only there 3 years, so I haven't cleaned up all the online things. So I would love to see that because we've written that some of the things that he's written we don't teach. I don't want to really address him, but we definitely I've written on the blogs.
Rabbi Lopatin, here are a few quotes. The simplest explanation for the differences between the accounts in Shemais and by Mizvah Dvarim is they were penned by at least two different authors with different conceptions of the desert experience.
Well, always be afraid of when someone says simple. You know, life is not simple, and I mean, the simplest understanding is that Hashem can write in any style that Hashem wants to write it. So that's even simpler. So that doesn't resonate with me, and again, I believe that the entire Torah was given at Sinai, Mipi HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and so, and whatever that means, of course, what is the peh of HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Hashem doesn't have a mouth, but it was all given by Hashem, so that I wouldn't agree with that, and I don't think it's so simple to say that.
So, let me go on to the issues of dealing with gays. In modern life, which is a very complex issue.
Right.
Now, we would all agree, I think, that in the Torah that we have it, you know, Torah Shebiksav and in Torah Shebal Peh, that Leisishkav in Ish, Mishkeve Isha, is an Issa Daraisa, and it's one of the Chayvei Mises, it's one of the Arayas, in the Parish of Arayas.
Right. Yes,
so, here's a speech given by a Rav from Chayvei Torah, at a LGBT prayer breakfast in Chicago. Here's the exact quote. Rabbeinu Shalolam, you instructed us in your wisdom in Sefer Shemais, in Sefer Bereishis, Lo Tov Hayos Adam Levadai.
Oh, that's, I could have given that.
Okay.
I don't know.
So Hashem, please bless our public servants. Everyone has the right to seek out the life partner and live in love together with full right with that person. Lo Tov Hayadas Levadai. And based on, basically, within the spirit of this, that the Illinois passed the Religious Freedom and Marriage Fairness Act, this was in Chicago, guaranteeing the right of same-sex couples to marry. And there was a message given out, as rabbis, and which I believe Rabbi LePatin advocated, the same begins, as rabbis, parents, and citizens of Illinois, we want to all offer all loving and committed couples in our community the support and protection of having the state recognize their marriage. So I would ask you as follows. I can understand that Orthodox Judaism does not want to, wants to support the separation of church and state.
Mm-hmm.
But to come out and say that Lo Tov Hayos Adam Levadai implies that gay marriage should be condoned and is in fact is a good thing, Lo Tov Hayos Adam Levadai, but on the contrary, the Torah supports it, is that what the Torah means? Lo Tov Hayos Adam Levadai, and at the same time, Vaisishkavim Ish Mishkavei Ish, I mean, aren't we basically advocating that the Torah sort of has become incorrect at this period of time?
No, chas v'shalom. I mean, I think you have to, if all marriage or really companionship, because I don't know, you know, marriage is a funny word, and we don't have kiddushi between men or, you know, women or anything
but
like that.
But they do have marriage licenses,
right?
Today,
which
is what the bill supported, right?
Right, because once...
To make it legal as a male-female marriage, not companionship,
right,
well, but to give them all the laws, et cetera, and a marriage license, which notably, you know, that clerk didn't want, but to give it the same gravitas and legal thing as a male and female marriage. So to say Lo Tov Hayos Adam Levadai and to make a tefillah for it, Rabbeinu Shalaylam,
isn't that... Well, no, so again, a couple of things. First of all, yes, separation of churches. So if the state, I think, should not actually be recognizing any marriage, it should be civil union, and marriage should be with your religious leader or your spiritual
leader.
But if the state is recognizing marriage, then it should not discriminate. And now let's get to a more important issue, which is, you know, is companionship, is a man being with another man, is that what the Torah is talking about? First of all, Chazal are very clear. They want to say that, you know, can we call bishlofera? We don't have to explain that explicitly. But Chazal were very careful to say the Torah is talking about a certain specific sexual act that's prohibited between men. And if we want to define companionship between two lifelong partners as all about sex, and as all about a certain type of sex, then you're right. Making that equation would be right. But I don't think that's what the Torah believes and our tradition believes, and it's not about that. And so to tell a young man or a young woman who cannot connect with a member of the opposite sex, who is homosexual or a lesbian or gay, to tell them you have to lead your life, either change your sexual orientation, which we know is very problematic and harmful usually to anyone who attempts it, but or tell them you're going to have to lead your life alone for the rest of your life. You're not going to have a companion. You're just going to have to lead a lonely life. I think that's wrong, and I think the Torah definitely is saying that that's not what Hashem wants. Hashem wants us, like, look, if someone wants to be a loner, you know, terasu naso, not get married, you know, fine. But in general, people want that companionship. And I'll tell you, if you look on in Israel, on some of the sites, there are Orthodox organizations, from ones for Orthodox gay men. They talk about the concept of chaver l'chayim.
But do you think when the government is advocating gay marriage, they're talking about platonic gay marriage?
That's what it's not about sex. It's not about, look,
the marriage would not include physical relations. Is that when we talk about marriage, we're talking about, I agree, it's not only about physical relations, but are you saying it's contemplating companionship without physical relationships when we talk about marriage? If somebody was in love with their brother or sister, and they wanted to get married in incest, and they said, look, this is the only person I love, would you say the same statement, lo tov heyos adam levado? It's just another one of the parshas of Arias, a brother, a sister, or a father and a daughter, and let them get married, and let's assume that it doesn't allow for relations. Would you make the same statement?
No, I wouldn't. First, because everyone has an opportunity to look in the world and spend their time finding a man. God willing, they're of the opposite sex, if they're a woman, and they just need to. Torah wants them to move beyond their sibling, beyond not.
But if they fell in love and they said, "This is the one I love," would we say lo toveyas adam levado and assume that the marriage is asexual?
No, I think we wouldn't. I think that's not where we are. And I think that the key thing is it's not about falling in love. It's not that this is the person I fall in love with, because I agree with you there. Let's say someone falls in love with a non-Jewish person. I would say it's usher to marry them. No. We advocate...
But it says lo tov heyos adam levado.
Yes, so it's not about... find someone you love and marry them and live with them and all its implications. It's about the Torah doesn't want to condemn Adam HaRishon to having to live alone. So there has to be an opportunity for people to find a lifelong partner. If someone loves their sister dearly, that's great, but they have an opportunity to find a lifelong partner outside of that. If someone is gay, they should not... connect with someone of the opposite sex, because it's very harmful, that kind of relationship. I mean, I don't want to, that's a difficult area to go into, but the idea is not condemning someone, exactly what the Torah says. Look, she's chatein in mishu, she kach ish in mishu ohev, or something like that. It's not about whoever you fall in love with. It's just that we have to make sure that people have the opportunity, the reasonable opportunity of finding a partner and finding a lifelong partner. And for gay people, that means someone of the same sex. They have to have that opportunity. It's interesting because the Midrashim talk about Cain and Hevel, that they married their sisters, Olam Chesed Yibaneh, that in the beginning, the only opportunity they had for fulfilling Lo Tov Heyot Adam Levado was incestuous relationships, according to that Medrash. But now, they thank God, we're living in a world that has many people in it, and you can fulfill Lo Tov Heyot Adam Levado not with your sister. But a gay person cannot fulfill lo tov heyot adam levado with someone from the opposite sex. Usually, it's very, a very harmful thing. And so that's why I think they have the right. But it goes, we're not talking about sexual relations. That's a whole other
discussion. Now, so let me ask you a question, Rabbi Lopatin. Isn't it, though, a little naive to assume that when we talk about the Illinois, or that the government contemplating gay marriage, that they're talking about asexual relationships?
The question of what kind of intimacy two men can have beyond Mishkav Zachar, beyond that, is a very important question that we have to deal with. And halacha, I don't think we've spent enough
time. We agree, but Lepan, I think that the issue, at least for me, is that we can recognize that gays have an extremely challenging life under orthodoxy and a real struggle. But to come out and support it, so for example, Ramesha Feinstein was asked, can you honor somebody who's a balavera? He was intermarried at a shul dinner, a physician who was greatly helpful to the community. And because there's all kinds of problems. We have the Isser, the Urayim says, this is free, Loisach Nisem, it's an Isser Daraisa, it's a Bichayin of Arash. Ramesha writes, you're allowed to honor him is because you're not honoring the part of him that is evil. You're part of you're honoring the fact that he helps the tzibur and no mention of it. But to come out with a supportive statement, here's a statement from Rabbi Yisachar Katz, the head of Halacha in Chayvavei. At least that's what his website says. Every modern Orthodox rabbi who doesn't denounce the offensive RCA statement, the RCA objected to the Supreme Court's redefinition of marriage. He says, every modern Orthodox rabbi who doesn't denounce the offensive RCA statement is over im hacherish nachrish beis azais revach vat sala yamid la yehuda mimakim acher v'anu beis avinu tzayved. I mean, to say that if you don't support gay marriage, you're over on im hacherish nachrish beis azais revach vat sala yamid la yehuda mimakim acher. I mean, do you think Reb Moshe, who in his tshuva writes here, and it's really a yireim, it's a safri, it's many, you know, paiskim, etc., that you're not allowed to be chayin if a rasha or a davara, would find it a little bit, I'm searching for a word, but to say that if you don't embrace gay marriage, you're over and hacharish nacharish ke'es hazayis, this is from Rabbi Yisachar Katz, isn't there a difference between saying, look, it's something they have to struggle with, and let's do what we can to be empathetic, etc., and something to say, let's embrace gay marriage, and if you don't, revach vatzali yamed l'makavachar, isn't that something else?
Well, I think, again, that goes back, when you're talking about the Supreme Court decision, you're going back to church-state issues. And yes, I think if he's right, that if the Jewish community supports the church getting involved in the state and saying, you know, we don't approve of these things because it's not our religion, then let's see, issues of abortion, the Republican platform now is going to say that even in the case of rape, incest, and danger to the life of the mother, you cannot get an abortion. That goes. So we have to be very careful as Jews. We're blessed to live in this country where there's a separation of church and state, and we have to advocate for that. And yes, I think that.
He's not discussing church and state. He's discussing the necessity to recognize gays. He continues. He says, "Vibrant modern Orthodoxy will write itself out of the parsha because it's not supporting a gay marriage." I mean, this is not about the issue of church and state. This is an issue about recognizing that we have to realize that, you know, LGBT is a very real, alive thing today, and if we're not sensitive to their needs, we will be out of the parsha. I think there's a difference between saying we're empathetic and saying Revach Hatzala Yamad LeYehudim Makam Acher and Hachresh Dachresh Keses Eis. Would you agree with that?
I agree that you would agree that also, that we have to be sent, it's a reality, we have to be sensitive to their needs. And that's really what he's saying. I heard Rav Willis gave a Dvar Torah after the Supreme Court decision. He said it, that it's moved from, gay marriage has moved from mishpat to chok. That, you know, with the Supreme Court decision, he understands that American society does not see it as a mishpat, as a logical thing. So then we have to look at our laws and our laws on sexual relations from our point of view as a chok. Very good for, you know.
That could be true. But here's another statement by Rabbi Katz. Ben Greenfield, a student at YCT, responded to Rabbi Katz. In the modern Orthodox world, Mishkav Zacha is now mutter. Time to deal with it.
I don't know what Rabbi Katz, but Rabbi Ben is a great student, and he's talking about attitude that people have. He's not talking about halachic opinion. He's saying that it's very true in the younger crowd. If you ask younger people, and I think that I know that this is not just in the modern Orthodox world. Younger people don't have an issue with these things in the same way as the older generation did. It's a real change in attitude. But, you know, we agree that we have to do what we can to help people that are gay, to be sympathetic to especially gay Orthodox or the struggles they go through. And one way of doing it is to say, we're not going to put up this fence against your companionship. You have to work it out. You have to, you know, discuss with your posek, you know, what are the halachot for a gay Orthodox Jew, but we're not going to put artificial mitzvot in front of you. And that's really all what's going on here.
Rabbi Lopatin, wouldn't it make sense for, as the Rosh Hashiva of Chayvavei, for you to say, listen, you can't say things like Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov didn't exist. You can't say that it's mutter. And because even though we could sit here and say all kinds of exegesis mm-hmm. into what you're meaning, when you look at what they say, you know, it's funny. As Jews, we say, this is Bibi's line. He says, you know, the Iranians say they want to destroy us. And we have to take what they say at face value.
Mm-hmm.
He says, because other people have said that. I mean, but wouldn't that... And, you know, when you look at a posek, let's take the other side of this, who said something that is a kula, and then some other rav says, nah, he really didn't mean it. He really meant it as a chumrah. You would say, look, they wrote it. They said it. We have to accept it. So when you have so many statements, wouldn't it make sense as Drash Hashiva to say, you know, if you say things like this, that when read, they are against Torah Misinai, that... You're not a member of our community. If you want to explain it, my dear friend, Rabbi so-and-so, please go ahead and do so. But we have to take your words as written. Otherwise, you know, we don't, the same verbiage we use against, you know, those who dislike us on the, you know, be it Muslim, Arab, we say, look, we believe what you say. We can't say we don't believe what you say, but here we do believe what you say. I mean, don't words mean anything?
Well, words do mean a lot. We make statements, for instance, again, that the Torah Misinai is non-negotiable. And, you know, as a yeshiva, we love our talmidim, we love our musmachim, we want to help them, we're a family. And so we actually, you know, we will definitely speak to a talmid or a musmach privately if we have strong disagreements with what they say. And we hope that, I think you're right. We have to continue to talk about our belief in Avraham Yitzchak Yaakov and the Masoret and our Emunah Kedosha. So we have to keep on talking about that. But, you know, as far as going after specific individuals, you know, we prefer to do that in a private way.
Let me end with a final question, Rabbi, because it's a quote from Dr. Erin Smokler, who's Yeshiva Smaret, Director of Spiritual Development. She makes the...
Remember, this is a wonderful yeshiva.
A spin-off.
Yeah, it's a sister because Rav Avi created it, but it's not affiliated with us. So she's an amazing teacher, yes.
So listen to this. She writes about Akedah. It was a test for Avram. There was a learning curve for God as well. Right?
Yeah,
it turned out that God has to learn along the way that there are actual dangers. I think that in a sense, you'll forgive the irreverence here, if you'll find this blasphemous, which I do. I think in a sense, it was God who failed the test here. I mean...
See,
this is a little problematic.
In the Chumash, if you read the Chumash, Hashem is the first one to say that Hashem has failed. You know, Nichamti Kiasitin. You know, a lot of times, oh my goodness, it was Shaul and with, you know, Noach or Dor HaMabul. I mean, Hashem tells us to believe that Hashem is making mistakes. Now, we understand it differently.
But when Hashem says he was Nichamti, it's one thing. But if Dr. Aaron Smoke were to say that God failed, is a little different. Especially since we say that we Vakedas Yitzchak Lazare Hayayim Barachamim Tisker is how we end up. The prayer of Rosh Hashanah is may the Akedah stand in our good stead. You know, Yom Hadin, and to say that God failed the test here, and that Avram and God both failed, and don't this sound like divrei kfira to you?
No, so I love this. You know, Hashem wants us to, you know, really take Hashem seriously and take Avraham seriously and take these things. So she's really, I don't know if it's not my pshat, it's her pshat, but I think that what she's saying is she's taking the story very seriously, reading it very deeply. You know, as far as Avraham failing, you know, it's Mefurash in Arashi and Rabban deals with this, that Hashem says, you know, I said Halehu, I didn't say Shachtehu. It's Pshat and Rashi. But I remember that Rabbi Ritter wrote about this. This was 25 years ago. I was at YU in the early 90s. And, he got in so much trouble, they wouldn't allow him to speak in the base medrash because he wrote about Rashi. That Avram, you know, one stream, of course, it's a huge chus for Avram, that his commitment to Hashem and, you know, Kavash, you know, Avram Rachamav, you know, so incredible. But there's the Rashi, there's the medrash that he misunderstood Hashem and Hashem never said to slaughter him.
But it doesn't say that God failed.
Yeah, this is taken to another level. I don't know what it means to say that, you know, Hashem. It means that Hashem wants us to see that Hashem, you know, didn't, you know, succeed in his own test. It's very difficult. It's very difficult, but it's not at all. There's no, you know, it's not one of the Yud Gimli calling that, you know, Hashem, you know, passed the test. Or you know, that it's fascinating to see, you know, and this is an important conversation about, you know, the perfection of Hashem. And I know other Kovei Torah students have gotten in trouble by saying Hashem made a mistake or this and that. But, you know, you read Tanakh and Hashem wants us to sympathize with how difficult it is running the world. You know, he thought Shaul would be good and then Shaul wasn't good. Of course, Hashem knew Shaul would fail, but Hashem wants us to feel that sense of failure. Hashem wants us to feel Hashem feeling failure. Hashem never fails. Hashem is perfect. You know, Hashem knows everything and is perfect. But Hashem wants us in kiviyachol, to feel what it feels like when you're failing. And sometimes the only way to do that is for Hashem to help us get inside Hashem's mind, kiviyachol, and feel that sense of failure. You know, certainly with Shaul, when you read that Haftorah, boy, it's painful, but you're feeling the pain of Hashem. And the Rambam would say, it's often to feel Hashem doesn't have any pain. That's Kfirah. But, you know, our tradition accepts that we feel the pain of Hashem. So that's what she was really saying, that, you know, get inside of Hashem's mind at the Akedah. And what did Hashem say, likely, you know, when that happened? And how did Hashem feel? So it's a different style, definitely a different style, but I think it's very consistent with a lot of Midrashim. And even
can you mention a medrash that says by that Akedah that Hashem fell?
Oh, that Hashem fell. A medrash that Hashem fell. I can't mention.
Well, I have to tell you, Rabbi Lopatin, one of the more fascinating interviews I've ever had.
Well, I take that as a deep compliment.
Yeah,
but really, and thank you so much for inviting me to this show and for having the conversation.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. Have a wonderful day.
We have on the phone with us Rabbi Avraham Gordimer. He's a writer for Cross Currents and Farut Sheva, and he's a frequent critic of Open Orthodoxy. Welcome, Rabbi Gordimer.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
So, Rabbi Gordimer, could you tell us what, you know, when you speak to the Rabbanim of Open Orthodoxy, they profess, you know, a strong adherence to Torah and Hashemayim, and they see very little difference between modern Orthodoxy, and themselves. What are your issues with them?
My issues, first of all, let's go to the first point. In terms of Torah and Hashemayim, it's true. I don't question the fact that at Chovei Torah, the yeshiva of Open Orthodoxy, I do not question the fact that they teach Torah and Hashemayim there. The problem is that many leading Open Orthodox figures, both YCT leaders, Rebbeim, as well as people affiliated with YCT and beyond that, have written extensively against Torah and Hashemayim, whether it's denying the authorship of the Torah, Torah Shabbal Peh, the objectivity of the Torah, the historical truth of the Torah. These things are coming out of those part of and affiliated with that group and that movement, despite what is claimed and I believe is taught in the school itself.
Now, when you speak to them, they respond, it's ayin panim l'tayra, they don't mean that, they like, you know, did you hear the interview that we had with Rabbi Lopatin?
No, I did not hear the interview.
Okay, well, if we had an interview with Rabbi Lopatin, and he basically says, mm-hmm. there's ayin panim l'tayra, they mean it in like mm-hmm. sort of a midrashic way, they don't mean it in a serious way, they mean it metaphorically, they mean it al pidrush. But of course, they adhere to Torah and Hashemayim, and how would you respond to that?
Well, I'm not questioning their sincerity. First of all, in terms of Shivim Panim LaTorah, the Shivim Panim have to be within Torah, with the authority of Chachamim, the authority of the Torah. If one says, I have my own Pshat, like, for example, there's some Open Orthodox rabbis who have professed various Pshatim in whether Torah Shemayim, in terms of where certain biblical narratives, certain mitzvahs, how to perform the mitzvahs. If a person makes up his own interpretation, as sincere as he is, if it doesn't fit into the Misgeres, into the framework of Masorah, it's not included. It's not sanctioned as one of the Shivim Panim LaTorah, and that's a very big problem here. Some of Open Orthodoxy's leaders are people who have taken stands in terms of, gerus, paskening, how to do changing gerus, other things, other very important things that usually the Gedolei Hador are consulted for, and we have a Masorah for. One can't just say in my own, take it into your own hands and say, I'm going to, work out my psak and gerus or work out my hashkaf in this or that. It has to be part of a Masorah. The Masorah might be broad, but it has to be part of a Masorah with authority behind it, and I think that's very lacking here often.
Can you give us a few concrete examples?
Yeah, sure, no problem. Say in terms of, going back to Tanakh and the Torah, one of the Rosh Yeshiva of Chovei Torah has written many times very sharply critically of the Avos. Not like, say, the Ramban in a few cases. He has made a few points here and there. Usually, if you look at the Shavel, you'll see there's always a mucker from an earlier mucker, but saying things like Avram Avinu was a bad father, Yaakov Avinu didn't know how to handle himself, Moshe mishandled the Korach episode entirely, Avram failed the Akedah, things like that. I think they're just outrageous allegations against the Avos, against the Imahos, against Moshe Rabbeinu, which have really no Masorah for them, and really change our whole attitude towards Torah. It's true, it's an interpretation of an Orthodox rabbi, but it doesn't mean that it's part of the Masorah and part of the acceptable interpretation and approach to Torah understanding.
Okay, could you give us some more examples?
Yeah, sure. Let's go back to the Gerus case. In terms of Gerus, some of the Open Orthodox rabbis took it upon themselves after a Gerus, like a mikveh scandal, probably heard about it in Washington, D.C., but they wanted to rethink the idea of the role of Beis Din during Gerus. So they worked out a psak that the Beis Din does not have to be at the mikveh. They don't have to be in the room of the mikveh. Now, the way it works normally is that if it's a woman who's being tovil, the Beis Din stands very far. I've talked to many Dayan and Prompton them. They stand very far away. They don't face her. They're totally opposite end of the room. A woman attends to the person, the Gioris at the time. And that's it. And the Beis Din just takes a quick glance from a distance, from like 50 feet, 50 yards away, making sure that there's a submersion in the mikveh, and that's it. However, though, and that's requirement halachically. It's in the Shulchan Aruch. That's the way that's passed by Reb Moshe, by Reb Adi Yosef, Reb Moshe Sternbach. Some of the Orthodox rabbis have taken upon themselves to change the Gerus procedure. They wrote two teshuvos in which they reasoned that there's no requirement for the Beis Din to be on site. They can be in another room with the door locked in between them, and someone will notify them that the woman that did the tevila. That's not the norm of halacha. They worked it out based upon their understanding and makaris they have, but it's really not part of our masorah of how halacha is paskin. And more so, you have to turn to authority. If all the Gedolei Hador are paskining one way, whether it's Golit or from YU, from MTJ, from Bnei Brak, wherever they are, and I'm working out because I think I have a psak, it makes sense, and I'm implementing it, we have no masorah for that. Say women rabbis. Open Orthodoxy ordains women rabbis. They have two yeshivas to ordain women rabbis. All of the Gedolim have talked about that have said you can't give smichah to a woman, whether they're posting from the RCA and YU, posting from more the yeshivish world, they've all said you can't do that. Whereas Open Orthodox says, we have a few rabbis, a few of our sages who do not measure up to anywhere near the postgame who say you can't do this, and they've therefore we're going to give smicha to women, we're creating women rabbis. It's this unilateral maverick approach, not having a certain feeling of submission to the Masorah, that's, I think, causing a lot of these problems.
Now, give me a few other examples where you would find objectionable about because I understand the Novominska Rebbe, etc., has really come out against them in a, extremely strong verbiage. Give me a few other examples of what he would find very objectionable.
I would think, say, in terms of gay marriage. I mean, obviously, we have to. There are a lot of people. Some people have these same-sex tendencies. Rabbanim do discreetly, privately deal with them, work with them, help them, provide support, try to be madrich them, and so forth. But Open Orthodoxy has taken another stance. Many of their leaders have come out in favor openly of gay marriage, legalizing gay marriage, and that's what the Supreme Court did. That was one thing, and not only that, but even encouraging and celebrating it. One open Orthodox rabbi wrote that he organized an engagement party for two men together.
Which rabbi would that be?
Yeah, I probably shouldn't say he's not one of the, I probably shouldn't say his the name, but it was in the papers, but it was online and so forth. Another one has Rabbi Avi Weiss has written how he's in an interview that he welcomes and register in his shul men as gay couples. Obviously, if two people come to shul together, unmarried men, we're not going to ask questions. It's not our business and so forth. But to register people who were openly homosexual as a couple or as a family unit in a shul, that's something that's not normally ever done. But Open Orthodoxy is now doing that.
So say that again. They are openly welcoming couples. Is that what you're saying?
Right. In other words, if you have a man and a man or a woman, and they say, we are wife and wife, we are husband and husband, we are a gay couple, we openly declare ourselves as a couple, the shul will register them with a family membership or a couple membership. It's true. One thing is that some shuls will register people who maybe have this tendency as yechidim, as individuals. They don't ask questions, whatever, unmarried men, fine. But to have men come in as they declare themselves as a couple, we are a gay couple, the shul register them as a membership, as a family or a couple, that's another story. That's very problematic. Some rabbis up in Orthodoxy have even suggested celebrating the simchas of these families. They say they adopt a child, having a simcha in the shul, the adoption, gay men adopting children, all types of things that are totally outside of not only the Masorah, but the whole attitude of Torah and the whole attitude of Chachamim. That's really very problematic.
And what do they do with the medrash that says,
very good kasha. That I do not know. I have not posed that question. I do not know. That's a great kasha, and I don't think there's a good answer to it.
So what do you hope to accomplish with your writing about Open Orthodoxy?
My hope really is, number one, to alert people to the problems. A lot of people say, oh, there's an Orthodox rabbi, therefore everything must be fine. I can rely upon him as a halachic authority. People should be, prudent. They should be aware that that's not always the case, obviously, especially in this situation. Number two is my goal really is to, for those involved in this movement to really rethink their direction, the trajectory, to realize we've gotten to a point that not only originally was started as like a non-yeshivish or less yeshivish or less or more left-wing version, say, of YU of Reitz. But it really went so far, whether it's in terms of the ordaining women, the gay issues, Tormin HaShemayim, but some of the graduates, some of the leaders of this movement, changing Gerus, so many other things, interfaith, interdenominational relationships. It's gotten so far that I wish people involved there would just realize maybe we should rethink how we're going, try to realize how far we've gone out of the norm, away from normative orthodoxy. What can we do to try to, return and become part of things and just, realize how far we've gotten. That's really part of my goal. It's not to attack. Some people accuse me of being all I want to attack and negativity. That's not my goal. I have no interest in that. I don't have the time to do that. That's the last thing I want to do. But to make people realize how far they have gone, they have to rethink and just, hopefully return back into the fold.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Gore. So before we close off, Rabbi Gore, and we'll edit out this piece. If you had one message, give us one message to the Rabbanim of modern of Open Orthodoxy, what would it be?
The message is that you should please realize where your movement has taken you, to please reconsider where you're going, the steps you've taken, and look towards either your Rebbeim or your Rebbeim's Rebbeim, and think back to the beautiful Masorah that we'd love you to come back, to return to, so we can work together as Rabbanim and Achdus.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Gordimer.
Thank you very much. Great speaking with you.
Bye-bye. With us, Rabbi Yisachar Katz from Yeshivas Chayvavei Torah. He is the head of the Halacha and Gemara department. We will continue this discussion, and we will have rejoinder from most talented author of a book, Open Orthodoxy, Is It Truly Orthodox?, which you can get both on Amazon and at your local Sfarim store. Looking forward to seeing you. This is David Lichtenstein for Headlines Radio.